sky, there is no bird, there is no cloud, there is no wind, there is no rain, there is no sun, there is no time. Weather's okay, there is no sun, there is no time, there is no friends, no passers-by. I'm walking alone, happy enough, nowhere to go, there is no time, I'm on my own, under the sky. Under the sky, there is no birds, there is no cloud, there is no rain, there is no sun, there is no wind, there is no time.
WFMU. It's Radio Ravioli. It's me, Olivia. Our website playlist is down right now, so I've been trying to keep track of what I'm playing, but and also talking to Lily, who's hosting the show next. She's guest hosting for Mark Hurst. So I kind of can tell. We heard Ellen Arkbro just then with Out of Luck. Before that, it was Ella Orleans with Walking Man. We also heard Claire Rousset doing a duo with Helena Dayland. The track is called Deceiver. Before that, it was Zayla with Fire Escape. I played some other things too, but I honestly can't remember right now. I've become too reliant on technology. This is what Mark is warning about. Oh my God. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City in Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online WFMU.org. I'll be back next week. Stay tuned for the wonderful Lily, guest hosting for Tectonic and covering for Mark Hurst. Coming up next. Bye.
Hello, WFMU listeners. My name is Lily Wen, and I usually host Buzzsaw on WFMU. Today, I'm filling in for Mark Hurst, Tectonic. Thank you so much for having me. Today, I wanted to explore the effects of surveillance on our music listening habits and experiences. So obviously, our behavior changes when we're being watched. And streaming companies that account for 84% of recorded music revenue have incentive to monitor what we hear so that they can keep us engaged. And I wanted to understand how this affects our relationship to music and how we consume it. We used to listen as a very active practice, making mixtapes, sending music as gifts, treasuring our MP3 library and those random digital files that you ripped one day and can't find on the internet anymore. And I'm wondering if we've slipped into a more passive way of listening and if our personal connection to music is being stripped of its context. Because right now it seems like the streaming platforms are pushing quantity over quality, and just the per stream valuation of music will always reward more streamable music, and maybe something, it might bury something that's a little like harder to listen to or requires more attention. I reached out to Liz Pelly, who is a New York writer who has spent many years reporting on the exploitation of music by the tech industry and the platform economy. She has written for The Baffler, The Guardian, NPR, Pitchfork, Rolling Stone, and other publications, and is currently an adjunct professor at NYU Tisch. She also spent years facilitating community shows at Silent Barn in Bushwick. And while talking to her, I also found out that she is a fellow drummer as well. She's working on her first book called Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist. That's going to be released in 2025 by Astra House. So she came over to my living room this weekend and we talked. And I'm excited to air this interview for you guys now. I was wondering, like, what your current day-to-day music listening habits are, if you even have the time to listen to music these days.
For sure, yeah. Well, maybe I'll start out by introducing myself.
Please, yeah.
So thank you for having me. My name is Liz Pelly. I'm a music journalist based in New York City. And I have been, for the past six-ish years, covering the music streaming economy and the impact of music streaming services on listeners and artists and music scenes. And like you mentioned, I've been working on like a big research and reporting project the past few years, but I definitely do listen to music as well. Basically, yeah, you know, most hours of the day. It's interesting, you know, I definitely, because I've been working on a really like intensive research and writing project for the past few years, I've been spending a lot more time on my computer than maybe even, you know, I've had like full-time desk jobs in the past, but it's been sort of more of like a day and night pursuit for, you know, at least the past 5 or 6 months. And it actually has gotten me thinking a lot about how different music listening habits become, not even when they're tied to streaming, but just when your listening is tied to a personal computer, and how there are certain ways of listening that are really shaped by listening through a computer versus listening through, you know, a radio or a record player, or a cassette player, even a phone. So yeah, I'd say, you know, these days, the past 5 or 6 months, my listening has been really tied to my computer in a way that it usually isn't, because I've just been sitting at my desk writing. So, you know, that comes in the form of an MP3 library, obviously spending a lot of time on Spotify because I'm writing a book about Spotify. And it's always interesting comparing the ways in which listening just fundamentally changes between those two interfaces, you know, like the types of listening that I feel like is feels more natural through your own collection of MP3s versus the way you might be nudged by a streaming service. But I also do listen to music a lot on Bandcamp as well, which is like certainly a whole conversation of its own, how Bandcamp has changed in recent months and years. And yeah, when I'm not on my computer listening to music in those ways, you know, it's often the radio, actually.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, online
WFMU, of course, yes. But also a lot of other local FM radio too. And on my phone, I listen mostly to the Bandcamp app, and then also just MP3s.
You know, if I have my MP3 library and then I want to listen to something that I just bought, like, I'll just stream it on my MP3 library. I won't go to the Bandcamp app. So, like, mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to explore and talk about is, like, aggregation of mm-hmm. listening and, like, how, we have Spotify or Tidal or YouTube and all these platforms that make it so easy to find so many different things. Obviously, like, it's great that new platforms and streaming services are coming up that are independent, but I guess, like, how do you see a listener, especially someone who's not super into music, like, dealing with going between platforms? Like, do you think that that's an issue and that that's changed things? And do you have any thoughts on, like, whether there could be a more one size fits all platform. Like, what are your arguments against that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I feel like personally, like, one of the reasons why I hesitate to sort of like, you know, ever advocate for one platform as sort of like a solution to all the problems of the streaming economy. Like, you know, if people often want this like very neat answer. Like, they want to know, like, what is the ethical alternative to Spotify? And I think that it's that question in and of itself is something like to really be challenged, because, you know, a lot of the problems of the streaming economy have to do with how, as listeners, we put so much stock, we, you know, get our listening behaviors like wrapped up in one single platform, and just the idea of like being beholden to or having all of your listening wrapped up in like one corporate digital enclosure is you know, creates lots of different issues. So I don't think that like the idea of, oh, I'm just gonna like switch from Spotify to Bandcamp, like, you know, like, we shouldn't be putting all our eggs in one basket, I guess, is kind of like one way of thinking of it. Like, I do think that kind of having a for artists and for listeners, like a wide variety of like platforms and projects and like ways that people access and engage with music, like, just contributes to a healthier music like ecosystem, so to speak. So yeah, you know, like, definitely don't ever want to like advocate for the idea of sort of like getting all of your listening wrapped up in like one corporate platform, even if it is one that like is generally like more fair.
So I listened to Spotify for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And every month, like, I would make my playlists, and I like put a lot of stock into it, because at first I wasn't down to go down that road, and then I was just like, I'm gonna go all in and just use Spotify. So, and since I've been off that platform, I'm kind of like, damn, all my playlists from those years are bound, like you said, like, bound to that platform. And I feel like in the streaming age, because you don't have even though it's digital, a tangible file that you can put on different devices. Like, if your personal playlist is on Spotify, that is not something that you can like transfer to other services. So what about like a streaming platform that wasn't a corporate funded thing? Like, do you envision any kind of like city or statewide local streaming platform?
Yeah, no, that is, it's super interesting. Like, so the book project that I've been working on for the past few years is called Mood Machine: The Rise of Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist. And I definitely have mostly been focusing on researching both the landscape and history of like the evolution of the streaming editorial playlist, and then also like the algorithmic playlists and like various different like algorithmic tools and forms of algorithmic programming that streaming services use to sort of like keep listeners engaged and basically keep people as returning customers to their platform. But there is this whole other aspect of the like sort of equation of playlists on streaming services, and like, you know, what is the perfect playlist that keeps people coming back, and like part of that is the playlist that people make themselves. I think that there is like one stat that came out at some point that was like a third of listening on Spotify is through playlists that people have made themselves, although those statistics are like always changing, and I kind of like always sort of question any kind of statistic that a streaming company is providing about itself. But anyway, a lot of people, these playlists they make themselves are like super valuable and a big part of what keeps them like sort of locked into this one sort of corporate digital enclosed data mining environment. I've heard that there are these tools that you can use to sort of like copy all of your playlists over to other streaming services. I don't know anything about them, but I do know that they exist. But yeah, I do think that, you know, that sort of like long game of like locking people into the platform just by like the very nature of the fact that they've like used it for so long is kind of, I think for a lot of people, why they stick with something like Spotify. You know, they launched in the United States in 2011, it's 2024 now. Like, a lot of people just get super, you know, not just used to using a platform like Spotify, but a whole part of their strategy has been kind of like, and this isn't just Spotify, but also if you go back and like look at kind of like the history of Apple and its involvement in music, like they're really kind of about, like they call it sort of like lifestyle management. You know, like part of the whole thing with Spotify is that they're not just sort of like trying to be the place that you go to and search for music and make playlists and like know what you're looking for, but also trying to kind of just be ingrained in your everyday life. So if you listen to Spotify executives talk about, you know, the products that they sort of like, or one of the ways in which they create like a valuable product, it's really like through being this app that people open like the minute they wake up, and they have like their you know, morning rise playlist and their yoga stretching playlist and their breakfast jams and their work commute podcast, and then they're listening to focus music at their desk all day, and you know, maybe on their lunch break they like catch up on a podcast they like, and then they have their driving playlist on their way home, and then they're listening to their dinner playlist while they're cooking, and then they're listening to a wind down chill out soundscape at night. You know, like they really talk about it as if like you know, part of the thing that is so valuable is the way that they are kind of like ingrained in like every single aspect of what the ideal user does. And to be clear, like this is them sort of like selling themselves, mm-hmm. and their value to you know, users, but also to investors, shareholders, by like claiming that this is sort of like their model listener. And those narratives should always be challenged when they talk about like, you know, the ways in which they've ingrain themselves into people's lives. But you know, if you look at the interface, like it really is sort of like they are constantly nudging people in the direction to think of music less sort of like this active choice that you're making in your life, or like this like outward facing thing where you're sort of like you know, thinking about what artists and albums and music scenes and music histories and lineages you're interested in, instead thinking about like your own daily routine and kind of where, how music can be used to sort of like augment that. And they do sort of nudge people in that way through like different things in the interface. Like, you know, if you open the app in the morning, it'll be like soundtrack your morning with your, you know, get ready sunrise playlist or something. So to an extent, like I do think that for some Spotify users, the experience of where music fits into their life like has been nudged by this goal of theirs to kind of be this like omnipresent just daily drip.
So the nudging happens in that people are just like streaming music throughout their day. Is that the way that you feel like these streaming companies are like, quote unquote, like nudging people or claiming to change people's behavior, or like be able to predict like what mood someone will be in on a Tuesday night? And can you kind of more go deeper into how these companies claim, as apart from their interface, but like how they claim to affect or change or predict behavior and moods, and like also, I know that they have a ton of partnerships. Can you also talk about like how they might partner with like Tinder to get in for mm-hmm. them both to get info on you as a user mm-hmm. to then spit back out at you.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I think so. The question of the kind of like nudging and that, how that happens, like, I do think that it's ultimately Spotify and other streaming services too. Like, you know, they claim that they gather all of this data on their users in the name of discovery and recommendation and delighting the user. It's like this phrase they always use. But it really, you know, clearly the goal is engagement and just creating a situation where, you know, you're not going to stop streaming or get bored and go to a different app. You know, they're trying to retain you as a user. Like, I think of the recommendation systems as like sort of like a form of risk management, where they're like, we have these engaged customers, like, how do we show them music that is like just interesting enough that they won't get so bored that they'll leave, but also just boring enough so that maybe they won't even, they'll like won't even notice it and they won't turn it off. Like, when I think of like the idea of like the kind of music that they sort of like push as streaming friendly or engagement friendly, it's like oftentimes just the kind of music that people won't turn off. And it's interesting, like, you know, if you talk to artists about like songs in their catalogs that have like unexpectedly become like streaming hits, like it's oftentimes like, you know, songs that have that kind of like sound like other songs, or just kind of like more like honestly like boring songs in artists' right. catalogs that tend to be songs that like do really well on streaming services. So I do think that, like, you know, the nudging, quote unquote, comes in the form of playlist recommendations, but also just kind of like when you open the app, if you're to believe the streaming services themselves, and I do think there's something to this, they say that like most users want to just open the app and have one button that they can push and just get like the perfect song at any time. So you're starting to see more of this through, like, you know, this year they launched this thing called Daylist. And I do feel like this kind of like represents sort of like what streaming services have kind of been after for a really long time. It's this playlist that just like changes throughout the day. And it's like a constantly changing, like algorithmically generated playlist. But it's really funny. Like, it has these really goofy names. So like, in the morning, it's like this like very long string of like sentence words. Like, it might be like sunrise, chill out, lo-fi beats with the medieval bent, or, you know, like, it's like a very like long kind of like string of words, and it's clearly meant to kind of be like very appealing to Gen Z. It's like supposed to be funny. They're trying to like make them so ridiculous that people will screenshot them and like put them on their Instagram stories, which, like, you know, I guess has happened, because apparently like a lot of their approach, I think, is kind of like, you know, how can we do something that is like so like weird that like people will post about it? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that's like kind of like part of the appeal of like all of like the fake genres that they've like come up with over the years as well. Like, they're just kind of trying to like generate conversation on social media, or like get people to make TikToks about like how weird their Spotify recommendations are, because ultimately their goal is just engagement, and they don't really care about like generating meaning or context or contributing value to any kind of like, you know, cultural discourse or teaching people about music. Like, right. they just want you to like press play and then forget that you press play, so that music just streams in the background all day. You know, so what is like the goal of all of this nonstop streaming that in their ideal world every person would be doing? And like you said, it's data collection. So, you know, in addition to they claim that all this data is collected in order to give the user a better experience. So they use this phrase called streaming intelligence, which is kind of like their way of justifying all the data that they have on people. And using it to give the user a better experience. But I always argued that I think that the line between streaming intelligence and surveillance is like very thin. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, actually, that's something that I think people have been talking about for years, but to me it's really interesting, like watching the whole conversation about artificial intelligence change so much over the past and grow over the past few years, because I really think both bring into question, like, you know, what do we mean when we talk about intelligence? And they're both like clearly just new ways of describing a surveillance state.
Totally.
Or kind of like the use of surveillance to fuel some sort of like new corporate product category that can help corporations do things more efficiently. Anyway, so they claim that they're using all this data for streaming intelligence, but then there's a whole other aspect of their business as well, which is advertising. So they, you know, love to hype up all this data they have on users and then use it both to kind of like sell people on targeted advertising on their platform and then also to partner with companies, data brokers, marketing firms, and like you said, companies like Facebook and Tinder. There's this great book that just came out recently by this researcher and academic named Eric Drop called Streaming Music, Streaming Capital, that I highly recommend if anyone's interested in this. And he has this whole chapter called Music is a Technology of Surveillance, where he also talks about this partnership that Spotify has with, or had with 23andMe, mm-hmm. To kind of like creepy. Give people playlists that sort of like speak to their ancestry or whatever. But yeah, he like gets more into the details of a lot of those like collaborations with, he gets into that collaboration, super interesting. So yeah, like, you know, another dimension to all this data collection is just being able to then take that data as a commodity and sell it to other companies and other data brokers. Like, I did a bunch of research a few years ago on Spotify's ongoing collaboration with one of the biggest marketing agencies in the world called WPP, and how they were like really proudly, you know, proudly celebrating the fact that they were like the first marketing agency to collaborate with Spotify on infusions of mood data into their like broader data advertising ecosystem. That's like, it's super interesting thinking about how they use data not just to like, you know, quote unquote, like strengthen their own product, but how it kind of becomes its own product in and of itself, which they then sort of like go and sell to other companies. And the other thing I always like to say, and then their advertising business as well, is like, you know, there is this question of like, what does it mean for Spotify to have all this mood data? Like, you know, what does it mean for all these other companies to have all this mood data? Is it like, what can they actually do with it? And I think that it's always worth sort of like remembering that these companies are always going to like super overhype what they're able to do with this data, because ultimately they're trying to like sell the extent to which they can invasively surveil people,
right.
As a product offering to advertisers. And I do think that like, in a lot of ways, it's like super overhyped. Like Spotify will go, or their advertising people will like go in the press and hype up like how cool it is that they can use all this mood data on users to like figure out, you know, what mood or activity or contextual part of your day you're in and serve you a contextually appropriate ad. Like they, you know, they like to be like, oh, like, you know, we know in the morning this person's always listening to a yoga playlist, so we can serve them a contextually relevant ad to their this literally is like something that one of their advertising people says, like, we can serve them a contextually relevant ad to their yoga experience every day.
Oh,
like, cool.
God.
Like, yeah, that's totally what people want in the morning. But a lot of that stuff is sort of, in a lot of ways, like, I think, super overhyped. So it's always something to kind of like be cautious of as well. I think to me, what's really interesting, and then I'll stop rambling, is like, maybe not even so much like whether or not mood data really is this like super invasive thing that companies can use to like, you know, they talk about how they want to not just be able to like monitor your behavior, but predict it so that they can know what you're going to want to listen to before you even know. Right. And they can serve you the right ad before you even know what, you know, like they know you so well. They are always like, you are what you stream. We know our listeners better than anyone. We have all this highly emotional data on them. It's not even so much like whether or not that is possible, but even just like the idea of it, like the idea that that would be a valuable product or a valuable approach to a company like Spotify, like a way of exerting power, I think like in and of itself is like really fascinating and like says a lot about, you know, them as a company and the way in which like these platforms sort of like seek to position themselves.
Can you talk about the idea that Spotify is a mood uplifter when they're also pitching the fact that they're like gonna give you what you already want to listen to? So for example, if I like only listen to hardcore music, then wouldn't Spotify know that like I wouldn't want to listen to some like easy listening stuff and like, so would they be feeding me more of like the hardcore stuff, or would you say that they would try and like kind of change what I listen to, or is that like a gradual effect, or yeah, how do you reconcile those two ideas that it's a mood uplifter and also personalized to your own tastes?
No, that's like super interesting, and that whole question gets into something that I think is really relevant in like the broader unfolding economy of like not just Spotify as this kind of purported mood stabilization agent, but like the broader context of all of these different apps and playlisting companies and AI music companies that sort of like claim to kind of like be able to be sort of like medicinal, like to kind of like treat different like ailments literally, or to serve certain functions. So it's kind of, it's, I feel like the music industry refers to it as like the functional music space. So like there's this whole cottage industry that I think in a lot of ways has arisen like as a result of the way in which companies like Spotify have sort of conditioned people to like reorient the role of music in their lives. But yeah, it's like this whole functional music space of like all these different apps that like claim to have playlists that you could put on to like, you know, respond to your biometric data.
Oh my God.
And I mean, they can't do this is the thing. Like all of this, it's like there's so much pseudoscience in the functional music space. And that's been like a really personally a big research interest of mine over the past few years has been like in investigating that a little bit. Because yeah, like you said, like everyone is different, and like the music that you think of as like, you know, a lot of these companies will have like, you know, playlists that you could listen to that are like chill out playlists or sleep playlists or meditation playlists, or like they claim to kind of like be sort of these like anti-anxiety tools. But everyone's different, and the music that you think of as calming, like, you know, like there obviously is power in music to help people like in this way, but everyone's perspective on like what will be something that is like calming to listen to, or something that would achieve any of these different functions that functional music like claims to do, like it's so personal. And yeah, I mean the whole field there's like is so like dubious to me, mm-hmm. but especially like the idea that any of this stuff could be like personalized through an algorithm, I think is something that especially warrants like a lot of pushback and criticism, especially when you start getting into the space of like, you know, like a lot of these functional music companies or functional music playlists, like they kind of claim to sort of be like wellness companies, which is so, you know, like, yeah, the work. Yeah, like, I mean, it's such a bigger conversation, but yeah, the stuff that these companies purport to do, like, should not be in the hands of corporate music streaming companies.
Totally. Yeah. Do you think that the trend towards kind of more chill and even in like mainstream music and Andre 3000's flute album and kind of ambient and chill and like music as a background experience, do you think that that has changed as a result of like the pandemic and kind of like more anxiety, or just the narrative of like, oh, everyone's more anxious, everyone needs to chill? Like, do you think that there's an uptick in it, and why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. I will say I do really like that Andre 3000 record.
I haven't checked it out yet. I'm super psyched. Don't get
like,
me wrong.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. It's something I've thought about a lot, because there's a, like a lot of different genres that have been like affected by the mechanisms of streaming, and I think ambient music is one of them. And there's this whole like, obviously like, super rich history of ambient music that I do think that, I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think that Andre 3000 record does, like, you know, at hopefully like lead people towards that like broader history of ambient music. But I think the risk is that like the streaming environment is so like, you know, passive and lean back, like, you know, they literally call like the ideal, or like, you know, one of the primary modes of engaging with streaming is like lean back listening, and it doesn't necessarily like invite or encourage sort of like a deep engagement with like the history and context from which music comes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, one of the risks of like all music being potentially like flattened into this sort of like, you know, yeah, like medicinal music as utility kind of passive vibe space of just kind of like moods and vibes versus mm-hmm. like histories and lineages to follow, is that you do lose like all of that like really important context and history to understand like, you know, how this music came to be, and like the, you know, the idea that somebody would listen to that record and not like learn about like all the various players who are on that album and the different like scenes that led to it exist, and instead to just think of it as like yoga music, or
right.
like, you know, to think of it as like wellness music, like that is like, to me, gets at so much of like what is honestly like kind of sad. But, you know, then it's kind of like, you talk to people about it, it's like you don't want to like discredit like how somebody could come to learn about a mm-hmm. type of music. I just don't really think that the framing of a musical relationship as functional or, you know, as like this utility, like invites that kind of like engagement. But yeah, obviously there's always the potential that somebody could like, there's always the potential yeah. that somebody could put on like a wellness playlist and then like learn about, you know, some great, you know,
cool
flute record,
scene.
but it seems like that's not really the point, or that's not
right.
that's not what they hope, because they hope is that what the streaming companies hope is that they will be in control of the relationship so that they can control the pipelines through which people learn about music, so that then they can like you know then shape it and nudge you towards music that costs less for them to license. So like,
okay.
you know, right now there's like, I mean, there's a lot of different things that could be discussed there, but maybe the one that I'll just mention is like, in the past few years, they've been testing this program called Discovery Mode, which is basically like a payola scheme that, you know, artists can opt into, where allegedly like you choose a track that you want to focus on and then they will like algorithmically boost that track in exchange for a reduced royalty rate. The way in which it's framed isn't really like how it plays out like in practice, but it speaks to sort of like, you know, yeah, what are the other reasons why a streaming company like Spotify would prefer that you are a fan of, like, you know, Daily Wellness, which is like this like music and talk playlist they have, versus like going and listening to like, you know, a spiritual jazz flute record. Like, they'd prefer that you have a daily habit around Daily Wellness instead of around like an artist who you're engaged with or who you're like a fan of, because then they control that pipeline. And, you know, if an artist decides that like they want to remove their music from Spotify because it's like an unfair situation for artists, or they like are not down with like all of the extraction and data mining and the way that music is disrespected in this environment, like, well, the user's daily routine is around Daily Wellness, then like it doesn't matter if artists are removing their music, because they'll just put something else on there. And better yet, they could put something on there that is cheaper for them, such as, you know, a track that might be like enrolled in this Discovery Mode program, where they can like,
AI
push
track, where or no an one AI, needs
or
an AI
track, or like all this other, like, you know, completely or an AI track for sure. That's also a whole other thing.
So
it's not like a good situation, in my opinion.
In terms of like flattening out the context of music, I think feel like that's a huge change. And when I was on the streaming services, I checked out my Discover Weekly and I was like, you know, ugh, they think they know me, whatever. And then I'd come across a track, I'm like, yo, that track is actually great. And then I'd, you know, add it to my likes. But it was such a different experience of like discovering music through the algorithms, then discovering it like in real life. Like, you know, you usually get to know music like in contextual ways, and music used to be like a highly like personal thing in your life, and a song would bring you back to a specific moment. But because you're, you know, if you just like, oh, I found that on the algorithm, then there's like completely no deeper relationship, and that's why I feel like it was just like a total black hole those years that I was on it. Like, I felt like I didn't even know what I was listening to.
It's a really good point, because it's like, you know, you think about why people like the music that they like, and it's not because you know like songs that have like this one specific flute in it, so then they're gonna show you like a whole playlist, you know, like that's kind of like the Pandora approach to like music recommendation, is where music is just sort of like reduced to like sonic attributes. And like most people like the music they like because of like the communities that they've been part of, or the scenes that they've been part of, or because of their friends, or because they read about it, or because a record label that they really like released it, like, you know. That's not to say that, like, you know, it's impossible for people to discover or to learn about music in these ways, but I just feel like, you know, it's nice to like zoom out and remember the bigger picture sometimes, especially because people are always sort of like asking this question of like, how do I discover music? Like, you know, I'm so stuck in like just relying on algorithmic recommendations, and, you know, I think those conversations are always like important to remind people of like all the different ways that are out there for learning about new music, other than just, you know, having it come to you. In a way that's highly mediated through all these problematic structures.
Right. So you've talked a lot about Spotify's algorithms. What about other platforms and other streaming algorithms? So can there be streaming without surveillance and data intake? And also how do other platforms' algorithms differ from the Spotify one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, I have been doing a bunch of research on like the various Spotify algorithmic systems. And a lot of people have also researched this. It's actually, speaking of books, I shouted out one earlier, but there's also this other great book that came out last year called Computing Taste by Nick Siever. And it's like an anthropological look at the makers of music recommendation systems. Like, he did this really long, like, you know, decade-long anthropological work on people at streaming services who make the algorithms and how they think about what they do. And like, it really goes in depth on, and it's not just Spotify, like he also looks at like other companies as well. So just shout out to that if you like really wanted to get into kind of like actually how the Spotify algorithms work, like what data sources are they incorporating and like how is it shaped, like, you know, or and beyond Spotify, it's interesting. But yeah, I haven't really spent that much time. Like, I would love if someone would do like this deep of research on like the Apple Music and like Amazon Music recommendations. But I do know that, like, you know, they, Spotify didn't invent the idea of recommending music by mood and by trying to sort of like, or vibe, which, like, you know, that's like a whole other interesting conversation of like how over the years this, you know, I think that for Spotify, like recommending music by mood was kind of like part of its really early history as a company. And over the years, it has become a lot more personalized, a lot more niche, as they say, like a lot more specifically fine-tuned ways of trying to get people to click on things. But yeah, I haven't spent as much time on like Apple Music and Amazon Music. But I guess the core question is like, is it possible for there to be streaming without invasive data? Like, I definitely, you know, do think that it is. And even just like unpacking that a little bit gets at like this bigger idea, which is like, you know, is it like the technology that is like the problem here? You know, the idea of streaming in and of itself, of like having a bunch of music on a server and you pay a subscription fee and you get to access it and like build your own playlists and things, like, is that in and of itself the problem? Like, I would say that it has a lot more to do with the way that like power and money and like corporate influence and consolidation like surround that technological equation than it necessarily does with like the technology itself. You know, even some of these like algorithmic systems, like, you know, I mean, if they were divorced from the economic logic of a company like Spotify, which is so much driven by the major labels, like when we criticize the economic arrangement of a company like Spotify, like it's really important to remember how deeply shaped that is by these black box contracts that they have with Universal Music Group, Sony and Warner, who like really in a lot of ways like have so much negotiating power because they own so much copyright that they're really able to like set a lot of the terms that then like all independent musicians and non-major label artists and labels are sort of required to exist within or operate within. So yeah, like I do think that it has a lot more to do with that just like general like corporate consolidation of the music industry than necessarily any like one you know, technological idea. And that's why for me, like a lot of the most interesting alternatives, like, you know, people are always kind of like suggesting alternatives to streaming or like trying to come up with like alternative apps. I mean, as like a journalist who has been writing about music tech now for like 7 or 8 years, like every single day in my inbox, like there are whole PR firms that exist like just to represent music tech startups. Wow. And like every day there is like some new startup that like is trying to suggest that they have like this like, you know, one thing that's gonna like save music or fix music. But if you look at like who's funding them, like, you know, the business models are like, they're never, you know, it's like the startup, the VC funded startup model is never going to be a good deal for like most artists and listeners. Mm-hmm. And that's why the things that are most exciting to me are like these few examples we have of like artists like attempting the like very challenging project of like making like cooperatively run streaming services. Like, mm-hmm. you know, for a long time, it's not currently active, but for years there was this cooperatively run streaming service called Resonate that was trying to create like a streaming service, but like run by a cooperative of artists and listeners, where you could like users or cooperative members would like vote on changes, and you could like attend meetings and stuff. And like, to me, it always was the thing that was interesting about it was like really taking the streaming model and like challenging, like, what would it look like if this was like, you know, run by a cooperative model instead of a corporate one. But the artist co-op I always point to now as like a really interesting project that personally I think more people should like be paying attention to or like looking at is this group of musicians in Chicago that run this project called Catalytic Sound, and they're sort of like it's like a 30 member co-op of musicians in kind of more like the avant-garde, like maybe like jazz adjacent music scene, like improvising music scenes. And what they do is like, it's kind of like a combination of like a streaming subscription, like kind of like almost Patreon type model, but like it's, you pay a subscription fee every month, you have access to the streaming server, like you can like stream all this music by all the artists who are involved, and then instead of paying artists on a per stream basis, they just like split the fee like 30 ways. And to me, that is like, you know, the fact that anyone is even attempting that is like so interesting, because one of like the core issues, like at the heart of like the streaming model, is the per stream valuation of music and how that kind of like influences so many things about the way that the streaming model, yeah, like prioritizes and incentivizes certain types of music and certain types of listening. So that's like really interesting to me. And then, as you mentioned earlier, I also have done a bunch of research into like library streaming. So public libraries all over the United States and Canada are the ones that I've researched that have launched local streaming programs, and oftentimes these are streaming websites that library cardholders, that anyone will be able to access to stream music, but then like library cardholders can download MP3s, and they typically are not just like streaming sites, but then they also will have like a whole board of local musicians or people from the local music scene who they invite in to like help curate it and make playlists. So they're also kind of just like creating helping create more cohesion in local music scenes to an extent as well. And they, you know, pay a stipend to the artists to license the music for like a few years. And to me, it's so interesting because it's like takes the idea of streaming that people have become so that has become so ingrained in people's lives, and suggesting like, well, what if this wasn't just kind of like this extractive product, but if it was actually like something that people could participate in, and that people could musicians in local music communities could like get involved with and like have a say in curating and governing these digital tools that are such a like deeply ingrained part of their lives. So, you know, a lot of these public library music streaming programs refer to themselves as like not just streaming sites, but as digital public spaces, mm-hmm. Which I think is really interesting. And there's like a kind of a whole interesting dimension to it too, where it's like, yeah, it's kind of beyond the scope of like thinking about fixing the music business and right. kind of more into just sort of thinking about like what are like the local cultural institutions that would really kind of like make a difference for musicians and listeners in their everyday life and like be accessible and participatory in a way that is maybe like more meaningful.
Yeah, that's really exciting because no matter what the streaming platform that's corporate, like mm-hmm. they're going to have their own algorithms, whether it's like to get you to keep listening mm-hmm. or their own incentives. So mm-hmm. to have something where it's like local artists and music fans who take that seriously, like any alternatives would like that would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone from Brooklyn Public Library or New York Public Library is listening, we should totally have one of these in New York.
Absolutely. Yeah, because they're in cities all over the U.S., but not here.
Yeah, like, so the article that I wrote about library streaming services was written for the Pioneer Works broadcast, and it's called Library Streaming, and in there I kind of, like, chronicle the, like, history and scope of those and, like, the cities where they do exist, and I can't... The way I learned about it was through the Chapel Hill, North Carolina library has one. And I thought that was really interesting because there's like a whole independent music, rich music history in that area. Mm-hmm. So that was like my introduction to the concept. But yeah, it turns out that not only like are there libraries all over the country, but it's not covered in the article, but like more recently I've learned that like there's also a bunch of libraries in Europe that have been sort of like trying out this model like basically since streaming started, so it's pretty interesting.
Thank you all for tuning in. That was Liz Pelly. Thank you so much, Liz. And thank you so much, Mark, for letting me guest host today. I just wanted to sum up. First of all, bummer that the comments and I think the entire website is down right now. But hopefully this discussion can continue. So it's not just one company or Spotify that's making these shifts, it's like the whole internet and the whole trend of surveillance, and I feel like one of the larger issues here is like the asymmetry of these platforms where we just don't know what these services are doing with their data and who they're selling it to, and so, you know, unless we have some laws and regulations, there's really no accountability. So hopefully that will change, as well as all the progress being made to help reform streaming platforms. I thought it was super interesting about the per-stream valuation of music and how that's not where the value comes. If you want to listen to a song over and over, like if you listen to one song and it changes your life, then that's just as valuable. You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Not right now, but hopefully very soon we will come back on the air online. Online. But thanks again for tuning in, and see you next time. Bye. Thank you.
And good evening, folks. As you may know, we're having trouble with our website, WFMU.org, and that means that lots of you aren't actually hearing my voice right now, but the FM signal is up, of course, and the WFMU app is working. So if you're listening through one of those methods, then congratulations and welcome. And we hope to have the website back up soon, but not just yet. Anyway, welcome. This show is called It's Complicated. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at this time, 7 to 8 p.m. We bring you an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music, and it's always a pleasure to be here. I'm wearing a baseball cap tonight, by the way, and that baseball cap keeps banging into the microphone. So periodically, you're going to hear a sound like that, and that's what it is. It's my baseball cap banging into the microphone. We have not yet come up with a solution to that problem. I'm working on it. I'm going to start tonight's show with music from a group called Toad. They were a Swiss band, early 70s. We're going to hear a track from 1971, a heavy, what would you call them? I'm always talking about and playing music from this sort of early proto-Prague period. A lot of what at the time was called hard rock bands were among the first to sort of transition into what was early Prague rock, and I guess this group would fall into that category. Little bits of psych, some, you know, blues rock, just what was going on in 1971, but, you know, starting to make the transition into Prague. So again, this is a group called Toad from Switzerland, Swiss group. We're going to hear a record again from 1971, and clearly, this band spent hours, many hours, listening to Cream, and in particular the bass player, who was probably spent hours listening to Jack Bruce's playing. I can just tell. Here they are, Toad.
I can fly, yeah. And Have you ever been in the land of the condom boys?